Okay, everyone, can you please find your seats? Those of you standing, chatting around. We'd like to have plenty of time for the discussion as well as the lecture. Welcome, everyone, to this last plenary of the conference. I'm very pleased to see so many of you are still here. My name is Ingrid Sturm. I'm a sociologist of religion at the University of Manchester. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Jose Casanova and to chair this session. So Casanova is a professor in the Department of Sociology and Theology at Georgetown University, and he's also a senior fellow and chair of the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. As most of you will already know, Casanova is one of the world's most influential scholars in the sociology of religion. His best known work, Public Religions in the Modern World, which was published first in 1994, has become something of a modern classic. It's been translated into several different languages, and 23 years after its first publication, it's still on the curriculums and reading lists of students around the world. Casanova has written extensively on topics of religion, modernity, globalization, religious diversity, migration, and civil society, to name a few. And his work has provided very important and timely challenges to secularization theory and research, and has prompted new ways of thinking about the role of religion in the public sphere. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Professor Jose Casanova, who will speak about divergent global roads to secularization and religious pluralism. Thank you.
Thank you, Ingrid. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for hanging around until the bitter end. So there are a lot of more interesting things to do on a Friday afternoon in summer. Nice day, but thank you. It is a great pleasure and a great honor to have the opportunity to deliver the Karel Dobler lecture, named after a great sociologist of religion, a great theorist of secularization, and a great teacher for all of us who became sociologists of religion and entered the field of secularization after him. I am therefore very grateful to York Stolz for the kind invitation to deliver this lecture. The argument I am presenting today was developed somewhat in critical conversation with Peter Berger, who, as you know, has passed away recently. And so, in fact, I presented the argument, or at least the first version of the argument, when I delivered the Peter Berger lecture 2 years ago at Boston University. So I would like to dedicate the present lecture today in memory of Peter Berger. Sociology was born as a theory of European modernity, and to a large extent still remains anchored in those origins. A theory of modernity which, moreover, is grounded in a dichotomous binary distinction between tradition and modernity, understood temporarily as a before and an after in world history. The Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft is one of the best known set of such related binary terms. It stands not just for a dichotomous analytical distinction between two types of social formation. It actually is supposed to denote a processual conception of history in which modernization signifies a world historical movement from traditional Gemeinschaft to modern Gesellschaft. The theory of secularization is, to a large extent, just a subfield of such a general theory of modernization. Within the theory of secularization, traditional religion and modern secularity function as similar binary sets of dichotomous processual world historical terms. Secularization signifies a world historical movement from traditional religion to modern secularity. A world historical movement which, moreover, is not only empirically verifiable, by overwhelming collection of evidence and all kinds of data from European history, from the Middle Ages to the present, but actually the historical movement of secularization, like the historical movement of modernization, is also conceived as a teleological process. It is this teleological nature of the process that makes it predictable, so that the theory of secularization has from the start assumed that as other non-European societies modernize, they will also undergo a process of secularization. In some of the most radical theories of secularization, such as the one by Brian Wilson, or more recently Brian Turner, the structure of the theory, besides being an empirical reconstruction of European historical process, also has an intrinsically logical character which assumes the form of a deductive syllogism. Religion is a traditional form of community. Modern society has no room for traditional communities, ergo, religion will tend to disappear in modern societies. I must confess that it has not been easy for me to free myself from the persuasive character of such a syllogism. A syllogism, moreover, which I did not learn first while studying sociology, but one which I found most convincing already while studying theology almost 50 years ago in Innsbruck. For four years, from 1969 to 1973, I used to pass through Lausanne regularly while traveling by train from my hometown of Zaragoza to Innsbruck. In fact, I learned to change trains at Lausanne's main station rather than in Geneva in order to avoid having to cross Swiss customs by foot along with hundreds of Spanish immigrant gastarbeiters on their way to Switzerland or Germany. But I never step out of the train station into the streets, so this is actually my first visit to the city of Lausanne. Let me make very clear that I do not dispute the facts of the decline in religious beliefs, practices, and affiliation in basically all European societies. Those facts are indisputable. What I dispute is the theory of secularization, which explains those facts as a consequence of modernization. This is what I dispute. In a way, I have spent the last 20 years since the publication of Public Religions in the Modern World unlearning much of what I had learned in my previous 25 years as a sociologist of modernization and as a sociologist of secularization. It was not that easy for me to free myself from the deep modernist and secularist assumptions that I took for granted as a young European sociologist. Those of you who may have had the chance to read my autobiographical reflection, which appeared a few years ago in the journal Religion and Society, will know that the title of my intellectual journey reads From Modernization to Secularization to Globalization. As you will know, I'm not the only European sociologist of religion that had to undergo such a rethinking. Peter Berger's cumulative revisions of his original theory of secularization are probably familiar to most of you. I actually find Berger's most recent revision in his 2014 book, The Many Altars of Modernity, Towards a Paradigm for Religion in a Pluralist Age, most interesting. It is also, in my view, his best book since the publication of his early classics, The Sacred Canopy and the Social Construction of Reality, with Thomas Luckmann, precisely because in the new book, he turns to his early Schutzian phenomenological analysis. Berger's point of departure, and perhaps the most important insight of his revised thesis, is that, I quote, the new paradigm should be able to deal with two pluralisms, the coexistence of different religions and the coexistence of religious and secular discourses, end of quote. This is absolutely crucial. We need an argument which is able to account simultaneously for this dual form of pluralism. Religious pluralism, on the one hand, that is the emergence of a global system of religions, which I call global denominationalism, and secular religious pluralism, on the other, that is the emergence of differentiated by coexisting religious and secular spheres, both in social space and in the minds of individuals. But in my view, Berger's new paradigm is still too much embedded within a theory of Western modernization that views modernity itself as the carrier or catalyst of both types of pluralism, multi-religious pluralism and secular religious pluralism. Countering Berger, and this is my main thesis today, I would argue that the European modernity is certainly the carrier or catalyst of the second type of modern pluralism, the secular religious one, but not of the first one, multi-religious pluralism. As the exceptional process of European secularization amply demonstrates, modernity per se does not contribute to religious pluralism, at least nowhere in Europe. We need an additional factor or analytical framework to understand the emergence of a global system of religious pluralism. And this, in my view, has to be a theory of globalization. A globalization that both precedes Western secular modernity, precedes, so is there before modernity, and continues in an accelerated and transformed manner after Western secular modernity. In other words, global religious pluralization emerges before Western secular modernity in the early modern era of global interreligious encounters that accompanies the European colonial expansion, and then religious pluralization becomes accelerated in our contemporary global age in such a way that it begins to transform in the process also the heartlands of European secularization. We need a theory, or rather a theoretical narrative, that is able to encompass the intertwined European roads of internal European secularization and of external global European colonial encounters with the religious other. It is the second road of external global European expansion that serves as catalyst for the formation of global religious pluralization. European modernity leads to secularization, but not necessarily to religious pluralization. Globalization leads to religious pluralization, but not necessarily to secularization. It is the intertwining of both processes that produces the combination of the two types of pluralism. In order to emphasize the intertwining of the two European roads, the internal one of homogeneous confessionalization leading to religious decline, and the external one of global colonial intercultural encounters with the religious other leading to religious pluralism, I propose that we take 1492 as the symbolic date that marks the beginning of both processes. Unlike the symbolic date of 1500, proposed by Charles Taylor as the dividing line between the medieval world of religious enchantment and the modern world of secular disenchantment and pluralization of belief options, which is still framed also within Taylor, within traditional paradigms of modernization. The date of 1492 serves to complicate both our narratives of Western modernity and our narratives of globalization. On the one hand, 1492 marks the decision of the most Catholic kings to expel Jews and Muslims from Spain in order to create a religiously homogeneous realm. In this respect, it marks also the beginning of the European-wide process of early modern confessionalization of a state, nation, and people based on the principle cuius regio, eius religio, that served to organize the Westphalian system of states throughout continental Europe. On the other hand, as the date of the discovery of the New World, discovery, of course, in quotation marks, 1492 is also the symbolic marker of the beginning of the European global colonial expansion initiated by the Iberian monarchies. The Iberian colonial expansion, the Portuguese one into the East Indies, and the Spanish one into the West Indies, made possible the connection of the old world of Afro-Eurasia and the discovered new world of the Americas, linking the East and West Indies, thus forming for the first time one truly global world in novel transatlantic and trans-Pacific exchanges. In this respect, the early modern phase of globalization constitutes literally the first globalization, a form of proto-globalization which can rightly be distinguished from earlier archaic process of continental interconnectivity, which one finds throughout Eurasia, and later modern forms of globalization. Moreover, as we are celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, one must recognize that so-called modern or early modern reform religion, whether Lutheran, Calvinist, or Catholic, can hardly be understood as a traditional form of religion. It was rather the outcome of a prolonged disciplinary process of confessionalization led by national churches under state sponsorship. This disciplinary process created new types of religiously homogeneous societies throughout continental Europe: a homogeneous Protestant North, a homogeneous Catholic South, and three biconfessional societies in between: Holland, Germany, and Switzerland, each characterized by their own patterns of internal territorial confessionalization based on confessional pillars, confessional Landeskirchen, or confessional cantons. In trying to ascertain the relation between modernity or between modernization, secularization, and religious pluralization, it is important to stress the fact that at least within Europe, within continental Europe, the principle cuius regio eius religio, namely the sovereign determines the religion of his subjects or her subjects, remain practically unaltered through the transition from monarchic to national people sovereignty with the fall of the ancient regimes, or even through the process of massive democratization in the early 20th centuries. Continental European societies remain until very recently religiously homogeneous societies, and the only significant change has been that from belief to unbelief, that is unchurching, and an increase in secular religious pluralism, but not in religious pluralism per se. All significant differences notwithstanding, European patterns of secularization share similar paths from homogeneous religion to homogeneous secularity without noticeable dynamics of religious pluralization other than the more hidden dynamics of religious individuation which Thomas Luckmann characterizes invisible religion. At the level of individual consciousness, moreover, Europeans usually experience this process of deconfessionalization and the accompanying individuation as a process of temporal liberation from ascribed confessional identities. Phenomenologically, Europeans tend to experience secularization not so much as a process of a spatial differentiation within their consciousness of coexisting religious and secular modes, which according to Peter Berger would correlate with the differentiation of religious and secular spheres in society. Rather, Europeans tend to experience secularization as a historical process of religious decline, that is, of temporal and spatial supersession of the religious by the secular. I mean, the problem I have with theories of secularization is which they are automatic. Asians are supposed to produce other Asians without any phenomenological experience. With a phenomenological experience, we cannot understand why certain processes produce certain consequences. Asians can never be structural agents or independent variables or explanatory causes. This is the secularist moment of a philosophical conception of history tied to the Enlightenment critique of religion that understands the secular as a post-religious temporal state. The secular is what comes after religion. As Taylor has shown convincingly, intrinsic to this phenomenological experience is a modern stadial consciousness which understands this anthropocentric change in the conditions of belief as a process of maturation and growth, as a coming of age, and as progressive emancipation. It is, in my view, the combination of the dynamics of the confessionalization and this secularist stadial consciousness that accounts best for the unique pattern of European secularization without religious pluralization. I'm disregarding here the undoubtedly significant and diverse intra-European variations within the overall European pattern of secularization, variations which I have analyzed in other writings. Outside of Europe, by contrast, in much of the rest of the world, both the dynamics of confessionalization and deconfessionalization, as well as the secularist stadial consciousness, are usually absent. Although in Japan and China, modernizing elites as well as modernizing states develop strong secularist projects. What one finds more frequent is religious pluralization and religious secular pluralism with milder secularization. To understand the dynamics of religious pluralization, processes of globalization and their religious encounters linked to the external role of European colonial expansion are, in my view, more crucial than process of modernization. Analyzing the paradigmatic system of American religious pluralism, for instance, it is worth remembering that the American colonies became a refuge for all the religious minorities forced to migrate by the dynamics of ethno-religious cleansing connected with the process of European confessionalization. Besides being the home of Native American cultures, they also became the home for African religions brought by the transatlantic slave trade. American developments in this respect stand at the crossroads of both dynamics, the external process of globalization and of internal process of modernization, insofar as the American Revolution is intrinsically connected with the European Enlightenment. In this respect, the United States remains the first and paradigmatic case of the simultaneous development of the two types of modern pluralism, religious-secular and multi-religious. In order to analyze the formation of what I call the modern system of global religious denominationalism, it will be necessary to go back to the early modern phase of global European colonial expansion and to follow the encounters between mainly Catholic missionaries and non-Western peoples and cultures from the 16th to the 18th century in Asia as well as in the Americas, before the expansion of global Protestant missions and before the consolidation of global Western colonial hegemony in the 19th century. And the Jesuits, of course, were the pioneer globalizers. They were the first organized group in history to think and to act globally. And they were, for two centuries, the main brokers between North and South and between East and West. But today, I cannot go into this analysis. We can bring some examples in the discussion afterwards if you are interested. I'm now writing an elaborate, there is, for those of you interested, the edited volume on the Jesuits and Globalization, a project I directed, and I'm now writing a monographic study using the Jesuits or the prism of the Jesuits to develop what I will hope will be a revisionist theory of globalization. From a global comparative perspective, relevant is the fact that the religious-secular differentiation which emerged first in Western Europe has now become globalized. But this was not the result of process of modern functional differentiation associated with modernization, but rather the result of the European global colonial expansion and of the intercivilizational dynamics that developed between the West and the cultural and religious other. In any case, any discussion of secularization as a global process should start with the reflexive observation that one of the most important global trends is the globalization of the category of religion itself and of the binary classification of reality, religious-secular, which it entails. Leaving aside the question that has dominated most theories of secularization, namely whether religious beliefs and practices are declining or growing as a general modern trend throughout the globe, one can confidently claim that religion has become an indisputable global social fact, has become this in modern globalization. That is to say, religion has become a discursive reality, both an abstract category as well as a system of classification of reality used by modern individuals, as well as by modern societies across the world, by religious, as well as by secular authorities. Within the last decades, numerous studies have appeared examining the discursive processes through which the categories of religion and the secular have emerged in non-Western cultures. The very fact that the same category of religion is being used globally across cultures and civilizations testifies to the global expansion of the modern secular religious system of classification of reality, which first emerged in the modern Christian West. The paradox is that the globalization of the Western European secular religious regime leads not to the exit from religion, as it happened in Europe, but rather, as in the United States, it leads to all kinds of novel religious transformations. Indeed, what characterizes the contemporary global moment is not only the fact that all forms of human religion, past and present, from the most primitive to the most modern, are available for individual and collective appropriation. Equally relevant is the fact that increasingly they must learn to coexist side by side in today's global cities, everywhere, in the Americas, in Africa, in Asia, and today, increasingly also in Europe. Certainly, one finds throughout the globe a tremendous variety of secular regimes of separation of religious and political authority, as well as of state management of religion and religious pluralism, along with very different patterns of majority-minority relations, which are mainly structured by different forms of nationalism and by different immigration regimes. Yet the secular state management of religion is everywhere under siege, or at least in need of substantive revision, as it confronts everywhere the expansion of the principle of individual religious freedom, as well as increasing religious pluralization and new transnational religious dynamics linked to immigration and globalization. As I've written elsewhere, sociological theories of urban secularization were blinded by the European experience to ignore completely the significance of religious groups, religious movements, and religious dynamics in modern process of urbanization. This urban secularist bias or blind spot is evident in the fact that even the Chicago School of Urban Studies missed completely the religious dimension of this urban process in Chicago or elsewhere in America. Yet it should be obvious that in the same way that one cannot seriously study the African-American experience and its community dynamics without studying the black churches, one cannot study practically any immigrant group in America without paying attention to its religious dynamics. This is true of other immigrant groups, as well as of most immigrant groups in America today. If one finds such fundamental transatlantic differences between Europe and the United States in otherwise similar and comparable processes of modernization, urbanization, and secularization within the Christian West, the more one should expect differential dynamics which perhaps will tend to follow neither a European nor an American model elsewhere. So I don't like neither American exceptionalism nor European exceptionalism. The first thing is exceptionalism because it presupposes a general world process of some kind, which I don't see. A comparison of Quebec and Brazil, two post-confessional, post-Catholic societies, illustrate the same dual divergent pattern. Up to the 1960s, Quebec had been a homogeneous confessional Catholic society, arguably the region with the highest levels of religious belief and practice, not only in Canada, but in all of North America. In one single generation, as a consequence of the Quiet Revolution, Quebec underwent a drastic process of secularization. Religious practice and affiliation plummeted, and today Quebec is arguably the most secularized region of North America. A population which had been previously homogeneously Catholic had become, in short order, homogeneously secular and post-Catholic. As in Western Europe, the only dynamic of religious pluralism in Quebec was brought in by the new immigrants. Since the 1960s, Brazil has experienced its own quiet revolution. Brazil has also ceased being a confessional Catholic society. But the confessionalization of a state, nation, and population have not led to drastic homogeneous secularization, but rather to an explosion of religious pluralism of all kinds. Brazil remains the largest Catholic society at the dynamic center of global Catholicism, in itself very pluralistic, from liberation theology to charismatic communities to all forms of renovados. But simultaneously, it has become a dynamic center of global Pentecostalism, a dynamic global center for the transformation of Afro-American religions. São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, Brazil's global cities, exhibit increasingly pluralist religious dynamics, as documented by the most recent Brazilian census. By the way, not only these huge cities, every town in Brazil exhibits the same pattern of religious pluralization today. So it's not only the large urban centers that do it, practically every small town has the same, is undergoing the same process. While Brazil may be an extreme case, one can observe similar processes of religious pluralization throughout Latin America. Indeed, in just a generation, most Latin American societies have been transformed from being homogeneously Catholic to being religiously pluralistic with relatively mild secularization. I must say without, but mild. While there are significant differences among Latin American countries, the trends are uniform. A significant decline in the proportion of Catholic affiliation in some societies like Honduras, already less than 50%. There are more Pentecostals or more evangelicals in Honduras than Catholics already, the first Latin American society. A significant increase in the proportion of Protestants or evangelicals. A milder increase in the proportion of no religion. Before, basically, it was Uruguay and Chile. Now, no religion is also growing everywhere in Latin America. In every mild growth, but it's growing. And most significantly, a recent increase in the proportion of other religions, and not necessarily migrant religions, other religions. The fact that this religious pluralization has taken place without noticeable violent conflicts between religious groups is a story that deserves to be told in a global context where religion and religious pluralism is often viewed as a primary source of violence. Moreover, a global comparative look at post-colonial global cities throughout Asia, Africa, and Latin America would seem to indicate that the new world or American paradigm of religious innovation and religious pluralization appears more adequate and fruitful than the old European paradigm of secularization and religious decline. Indeed, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, all of them, grouped until recently together as emerging socioeconomic powers, are all characterized by diverse patterns of religious pluralism. Asia, of course, has been for millennia a continent of religious pluralism or of multiple and competing teachings, along with pervasive and diverse forms of folk religiosity. Asian religious traditions are being radically transformed by processes of modernization and globalization. But the overall trend appears to be that of increasing pluralization rather than a straight secularization and religious decline. Even the attempt of radical secularist regimes to implement a drastic secularization from above in China or in Vietnam have obviously failed. All religious traditions, old and new, appear to be undergoing some kind of new revival throughout much of Asia. Korea, a country which was not subject to Western colonialism, has become increasingly Christian in and through the process of modernization. One can find today Korean Christian missionaries throughout Asia and the Pacific. In our contemporary global secular age, what were at first divergent roles to secularization and religious pluralism are becoming ever more intertwined. More societies are becoming simultaneously more religious and more secular, though in diverse ways. But everywhere, the parallel religious and secular dynamics are becoming ever more intertwined and interrelated. Even continental Western Europe is being transformed by global migrations, and most societies are becoming increasingly more religiously plural, while also being ever more secular. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that very inspiring and interesting lecture. The floor is now open for questions. We have about 15, 20 minutes, so I think there's some microphones around here. Sorry.
Good. To see the people.
So if anybody wants to, let's...
I'm the first.
Okay. Let me stand. First of all, congratulations. This was breathtaking.
Yeah, I lost my breath.
Now, I think this was a brilliant exposition on this difference between the usual way of putting it is that in Europe we often think of freedom from religion, and in America they often think of freedom of religion. And these are two different things, and I think your entire argument builds on this distinction. I do have a question about the timeline. I do think that pre-modern globalization, before 1492, also has some aspects of religious pluralism in societies that were not Western European, but places like India or China, the Mongols, the Ottoman Empire, and so on. And that begs the question, if we are to make 1492 the entry point, then in what way is the American religious pluralism different from the pre-modern forms of religious pluralism that existed in Asia? In other words, what is the novelty that would justify the analytical distinction or not taking into account the previous situations? Thank you.
Yes, well, thank you. This is the topic for the book I'm writing right now. But basically what I would say is precisely when the Jesuits arrive on their own, because they were led by Portuguese colonialism in the Estado India, the Padroado. But once they got into Japan, they were on their own. Once they were into Beijing, they were on their own, alone. They had to learn the language, they have to learn the culture, the religions. And in the encounter, they began to make distinctions. What is Buddhism, what is not Buddhism? And in this process, they helped to differentiate religious traditions that had been relatively mixed and undifferentiated into precise differentiated religions. So the very category of religion emerges not as theories of secular modernity like my friend Talal Azhar and so on begins in the 18th century, and also not later in the 19th century. My argument is, obviously, Confucianism, everybody knows that Confucianism was manufactured. I mean, you have titles, huge books on manufacturing Confucianism. Ricci, the very name Kung Fu Tzu was an invention by Ricci, and the name by which we know Confucianism, Confucius, basically Ricci invented it. But most importantly, the literati that became Confucian Christians, they learned to free themselves from Buddhism and Taoism. This was the whole point, the project of Christian Confucianism that Ricci sold to some literati. Free yourself from Buddhism and Taoism, which are idolatrous religions, while Confucianism is a natural law, which basically is preparation for the gospel. In Japan, you have very similar dynamics. In India, with the Nobile and the Brahmas, you have very similar dynamics. So the first encounters between all these religions of Asia, before they became isms, it's true in the 19th century, but the first encounters, even in Tibet, Tibetan Buddhism, basically, Hippolyto Desideri was the one that brought all these texts to the West. So they brought all these texts, all these traditions to the West, and the West learned them in the 18th century. Voltaire, Leibniz, all of them learned them from the Jesuits. And the Orientalism then began to grow in the European universities, but it came from precisely these first encounters between the Jesuits. So the point I'm making is that precisely these first encounters are the ones that begin the process of differentiation. It continues and is fully developed only in the 19th century, but the process begins. And the argument is it begins in a way that was different. It was before there was a world system. You have global connected histories in the early phase of globalization, but not a world system. The West has no hegemony in Asia, cannot subjugate Japan, cannot subjugate China, cannot subjugate the Mughal Empire, cannot subjugate the Persian Empire, cannot subjugate the Ottoman Empire. So basically they have no hegemony. And yet the global encounter has started then. We could go into Latin America and how the encounters with those religions that were subjugated under Catholicism have reemerged today. Today Latin America is pluralistic because these religions, Afro-Brazilians, Indo-Americans, have remain within Catholicism and now have the possibility to open up and to create new dynamics.
Okay, thank you very much for this talk, and you're absolutely right that we do need to go back to our earlier modernity to see some of the trends emerging. I would have two quick questions. First one is, what would be your arguments to say that the process of globalization you're sketching prior to modernization, and what would be your arguments to say it is not as teleological as modernization? Second question is, I'm missing something in your very comprehensive portrait. It's the role of capitalism and the birth of capitalism with the colonial, the Spanish and the Portuguese were basically, private enterprises that were then statized. So capitalism at the beginning, capitalism in the middle until the 19th century with industrialization, and capitalism at the end when modernization trends lead to this new state of the world that we're all trying to understand. So what would you have to say to this?
And the first one, I would say that what distinguishes this first early phase, there is not a world system. It's not a center-periphery whereby from the center a form of globalization spreads and colonizes. But it's a question of interconnected histories. And then there are all kinds of different encounters and goes in different directions. Obviously, this is not the place here to discuss them. What distinguishes the Jesuits, again, that they have no problem dealing with the feudal warring states in Japan, with the emperor in China, with the Mughal Empire in the North India, with the Tamil kingdoms in the South, with the African kingdoms. So they have no project of a global system of nation states. They have a project of a global civil society in which people can go and freely change their religions, but they have no project of a globalization of the nation state. They have no project of a universal Christian monarchy. In fact, they compete with the Catholic kings that have projects of universal Christian imperialism. And then with the Pope, which at first is not interested in global missions, but then once the propaganda fide is established, establishes Romanization against the Jesuit method of accommodation, of developing Confucian Christianity in China, Japanese Christianity in Japan, Brahman Christianity in India, etc., a model of multiple Catholicisms, if you wish, before Romanization takes over in the 18th century. So it was a different project. It failed dramatically, it was defeated, but it was a different project, both at the cultural level, I would argue, and in the same way the global and the local are related. Concerning capitalism, yes. I mean, I would argue that Wallerstein thesis makes sense for the New World and Europe, the triangular link of the trade between Africa, Asia, or excuse me, Africa, Europe, and the Americas, but not for Asia. I mean, even today, economic historians recognize that China was only incorporated, and China was the most important economy, was incorporated into the world capitalist system only in the second half of the 19th century, why the British were able to break the walls through the Opium War. Before that, China didn't want any product, any commodity from the rest of the world, but silver. So the rest of the world wanted a lot of Chinese commodities, but China didn't want anything but silver. And that's why all the silver of America, yes, ended up in Asia. But it was not a world system in the way in which it did not transform the Chinese economy, did not transform Chinese society, had very impact on them. And of course, we know that Japan, with the Tokugawa regime, maintained some commercial contacts with the British and the Dutch, but certainly not. And you could argue, or some people have said, that actually the first transnational corporation was also the Jesuits, before the East India Company, before the Dutch East India Company. They controlled the silk trade between China and Japan. This was the financing of their missions for almost 80 years, and this was the main reason why Japan were interested in dealing with the Jesuits and with the others. So yes, there are capitalist exchanges, but not a world capitalist system by any means. So the world capitalist system really only emerges in the 19th century under Pax Britannica, is the argument. And my argument is today is not anymore center-periphery, it's a different, much more pluralistic dynamics. When the Chinese economy, which after all you could say is a combination of state capitalism, kinship capitalism, and basically casino capitalism, becomes the most important, or at least the second most important economy in the world, basically it's very difficult to argue in terms of a rational capitalism in Weberian terms. And we are simply entering into a different dynamics. We should be a little more less Eurocentric, Western-centric in our conceptions of global dynamics. I mean, my main interest here is to free ourselves from our modernist assumptions that everything begins with modernity. This is basically what I'm trying to do.
Another question over here.
Thank you for your talk. I wanted to ask you, your talk is very broad and it touches on many lines of modernity, and I was thinking of S.N. Eisenstadt's concept of multiple modernities, yes. And I wanted to know how you feel, if you feel like you're in line with his ethical line of thought, or you're diversifying, and how so?
Well, it's a version of Fidin Sofa, I mean, you know, with Eisenstadt, but I put the less emphasis on modernities, or I put the emphasis on multiple already before, insofar as he also links the multiple modernities to the Axial Age and the emergence of multiple civilizations, which remain there. They have been transformed by modernization and globalization, but ultimately, Japanese civilization, Chinese civilization, Indian civilization, basically go back to this Axial Age. And so in this respect, yes, I link my argument to Eisenstadt, but rather than begin with multiple modernities, I want to begin with a thesis of early modern globalization before the Western hegemonic modernity. That's basically.
A couple more questions, one there.
Hi, thanks very much. It was a fascinating lecture. I was curious how your argument connects to Charles Taylor's secular age thesis. In other words, this is a fascinating sort of more complicated institutional picture of secularization and religious pluralization. My understanding of Taylor's thesis with regards to secularity as an experience, the sort of phenomenological experience of the secular age, is that Taylor would attribute both of those institutional circumstances to being fairly conducive still with the basic line of disenchantment, the basic sapping of spiritual energy from everyday life, and religious or to the extent that one finds spiritual meaning, it's in an sort of an interiorized and somewhat optional accessorial way. Is the more complicated institutional picture, like would we expect to find differences between Quebec and Brazil with regard to the experience of the disenchanting experience of the secular age?
Well, Charles and I spent a year in Berlin together, the Wissenschafts colleague, when he wrote The Secular Age. He was writing The Secular Age when we were together, Hans Joas, him and me, having a lot of discussions around those issues. So I'm very familiar with the whole structure of the argument from within and out. Yes, this is my main disagreement. He begins, that's why I compare 1500 for him, means the marking of disenchantment. And I don't take, I mean, for me, the weakest aspect of Weber's thesis is the theory of disenchantment. I think it's a very weak argument that doesn't work very well. And so I don't buy it so much. What is important in his argument is the pluralization of options that come in our secular age. Exactly, he says the pluralization of options. And he doesn't differentiate between religions, simply pluralization of options, individual options. My argument is that precisely there is a pluralization of secular religions, but the pluralization of religious options really only emerges now in our global age, or it emerged in other places before. As to Quebec and, you know, Charles is an Anglophone, not a Francophone Quebecois. So he didn't go through the disenchantment of the Quebecois Iron Revolution. The Anglophone Catholics remain Catholics today, while the Francophone Catholics have become secularized. And he's one of these Anglophone Quebecois Catholics. Yes.
This time for one question, I think, at the end.
Yeah. It's me. Thank you, Professor, for a very inspiring lecture. So my name is Tipo Dak from KU Leuven. I wonder, what is in your view the influence of ideas on structural processes? Of course, you were very comprehensive. You mentioned the cuiusegio eius religio, that idea actually had structural consequences, and then later also a set of other consequences were linked to that. Do you think that some later contemporary ideas, such as freedom of religion or freedom to have non-religion, had influence on structural processes of globalization, and to what degree, in which sense? Thank you.
Yes, of course, but I didn't put cuius regio eius religius an idea. It was actually a legal implementation. It came out of the Westphalian Peace Agreement. I mean, it was basically already introduced by the Augsburg Peace, the Peace of Augsburg, but basically it was an attempt to put an end to the religious wars, but giving the king basically Hobbesian solution, the Leviathan. The Leviathan basically defines religion, and you don't let people have. So this was the idea then, and this was what confessional states meant in Europe. But there were other ideas that the Jesuits were bringing as Renaissance humanists. They were bringing the idea of universal humanity and of every soul being equal, and so they bring ideas through, because they were not only missionaries, they are also the first professional school teachers. When they are suppressed in the 1800s, they have 800 colleges all over the globe. So well before the state took over education and established any form of global education, which of course our school of Stanford sociology, school of globalization, of course takes this own homogenization as the characteristic. But how is it happen? So yes, of course ideas, these missionaries brought ideas with them in their encounter, but they not only brought ideas, they were confronted with ideas they had to learn. There was a lot of processes. They are the first ones to develop, Acosta, if you read Acosta's Historia Moral y Natural de las Indias, well before the Enlightenment, theories of stadial development of humanity, you have an attempt, because they are in contact. The Jesuit missionaries in Latin America in the 1560s know what the Chinese, the Jesuits in China are doing. And so in this text already of Acosta, you already have a comparison of levels of different regimes and different levels of development, including China and Japan. So it's not only the experience of all the different native peoples and kingdoms of the New World, but they already bring information from. So they already have a global outlook, and they try to develop an idea. Of course, it's full of references to God and to demons, and in this respect, it's not, we wouldn't go secular, so we discard it. But I tell you, it's less racist and less Eurocentric than the 18th century conceptions, cosmopolitan conceptions of global human development.
Thank you very much, Jose Casanova. Let's give him another round of applause.
Thank you.
Before you all leave, I'd like to invite Inge Fuset, who wants to say a few words.
Thank you. I'd like, before we each go our own ways, to thank our organizer, the one who enabled us to be here, and that's Jörg Stolz. As you all know, we were actually headed for Australia, almost. When that didn't work out, there was a little bit of confusion. A little bit of, now what are we doing, until Jörg said, as a good leader, I'll just do it. And I would say that we are all grateful to Jörg for taking this on such a short notice. There are many ways, the reasons why this is a good conference. And I actually had someone say to me, and I didn't invite that comment. Someone said, you know what, of all the ISSR conference I've been to, this has been the best. Not only one of the best, but the best is what she said. And I think there are many reasons as to why. One is the quality of the papers. I know that's not, we can't control that in the executive committee, so this is actually a compliment to all the participants. There have been a lot of great sessions, good papers, and I've heard several one's comment of the quality of the papers. But back to the conference, it's been extremely well organized. It's worked very well with the hotel, the locations of the hotel, the transportation, the campus, and I've heard some say, you know what, the food was great, and especially the coffee. They had great coffee at this conference, and the snacks were very good. You know, when it comes down to it, we're fairly basic. It's kind of food, entertainment, nice people, something for the mind, and we're happy. Well, Jörg, you, and I'm one more thing. The great band last night, the salsa band, I truly enjoyed it. So, you know, all in all, thank you so much for a very, very great job. So let's give him an applause. And of course, I realized last night I should have had him standing up here receiving the applause. So let's do it again. Due to my mistake, yes.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It was a lot of work to organize such a conference, and everybody who has done that knows that. But I would just like to say thank you. First, actually, when I heard a great conference by José Casanova, I thought, this is a great talk, but it must be difficult for the translator, right? They're so quick. but I want to thank the local committee, and especially the task force. Are they here, the task force? So Anaïd Lindemann, Manélie Faramont, Christophe Monod, and Pascal Tanner. Are they here? Stand up. Yeah. Without them, this wouldn't have been possible. I also very much thank the translators, all the our university, the people who have worked in the, you know, in all the institution, the council, and the executive. So all of them have really worked together to do this, which was a bit short notice. And thank you to you that you have come here. It has been a great pleasure having you here. We very much hope that you've enjoyed it, and we hope to see you again in 2 years' time. And we think it's going to be in Poland. So see you in Poland. Bye-bye.